So many of you will already have recognized that the title of my lecture, Fabulation and Metahistory, alludes to two classic works of humanistic scholarship, one from the discipline of literary criticism, the other from historiography, namely to Robert Scholes's Fabulation and Metafiction of 1979, and to Hayden White's Metahistory of 1973. What joins these two works, aside from the relative proximity of their publication, is an insistence on the significance of poetics as a vehicle for approaching historical reality. To be sure, each addresses the convergence of poetic discourse in the world of historical facts from vastly divergent perspectives. Scholes, the literary critic and literary historian, emphasizes the emphatically self-conscious fabulation, that is, invention, of metafiction, which he designates as a turning back of contemporary literature, this is a quote from Scholes, toward the stuff of history itself, end quote. For Scholes, the representational strategies of literary realism are impoverished forms that fail to capture the intricacies of the real. He asserts, quote, reality is too subtle for realism to catch it. It cannot be transcribed directly. But by invention, by fabulation, we may open a way toward reality that will come as close to it as human ingenuity may come. End quote. Experimental fiction thus does not mark a radical divide between the fictional and the real, but instead manifests the seemingly paradoxical attempt, quote, to find more subtle correspondences between the reality which is fiction and the fiction which is reality. This chiastic formulation is much more than just rhetorical play. It highlights the transitional dynamic that joins fiction and reality in a kind of conceptual continuum. Reality, as we know, is often stranger and at times more horrific and atrocious than fiction. The Holocaust provides the exemplary instance of such a reality that outpaces our wildest nightmares, and this has led some critics to suggest that in the post-Holocaust world, imagination must work overtime to catch up with the rationally choreographed, monstrous reality of Auschwitz and the death camps. Literary fabulation represents but one especially productive instrument for advancing this game of imaginative catch-up. With this, we've arrived at the position of Hayden White, except that the object of his investigation is not 20th century fiction, but rather 19th century historical narratives. For White, the heyday of historiographic realism, like the parallel development in literary realism, is predicated on a limited and limiting set of conventions. The great historians select from among a finite repertory of tropes, discursive arguments, and modes of emplotment in order to create their specific historical narratives. Operating tacitly with a Freudian model that distinguishes the manifest expression of the historical account, its surface of verbal phenomena, from the latent rules that serve as its generative grammar, White insists specifically on the poetic character of this deep structural level that inevitably preforms all historical narratives. This poetic dimension is precisely what White terms the metahistorical understructure of the historical work. On this latent and formative level of metahistory, White maintains, quote, the historian performs an essentially poetic act in which he prefigures the historical field and constitutes it as a domain upon which to bring to bear the specific theories he will use to explain what was really happening in it. End of quote. Metahistory and metafiction, hence, can be seen to overlap with regard to their grounding in forms of poetic fabulation. The primary difference, of course, is that whereas White's historian unconsciously relies on a repertory of fabulative techniques, Scholes's metafictional fabulators consciously, indeed self-consciously, exploit the tools of poetics as a means for disrupting, unsettling, and rewriting accepted narratives and also historical narratives. In the discipline of Holocaust studies, the relationship between fiction and facts, between poetic elaboration and simple insistence on the real has traditionally been fraught with tensions and with controversy. As early as 1949, Theodor Adorno gave paradigmatic expression to the absolute interdiction on the application of poetic principles to the atrocities of the Holocaust. After Auschwitz, he famously maintained, to write a poem is barbaric. And he later justified this by asserting that when subjected to the principles of aesthetic stylization, quote, the unimaginable ordeal appears as if it had some meaning. It is transfigured and stripped of some of its horror. Rightly or wrongly, Adorno's dictum has become a watchword of Holocaust studies. It has often been overlooked, however, that Adorno himself later revised this stern judgment, conceding in 1966 that, quote, perennial suffering has as much right to expression as does the tortured man to a scream. Thus, it may have been wrong to claim that after Auschwitz it is no longer possible to write a poem. Especially telling in the change of focus this revision of Adorno's earlier pronouncement entails is that whereas his initial prohibition was grounded in the formalist perspective of aesthetic enhancement, refinement, or modulation, his later retraction has its foundation in an implicit doctrine of literature as a mode of therapeutic expression. In this respect, the span of Adorno's positions already stakes out certain boundaries that traditionally delimit the terrain of literary representations of the Holocaust. On the one hand, overwrought aestheticization, fabulation, and formal experimentation are viewed with suspicion because they're perceived as strategies that cover up, redact, or ameliorate the horror of the camps and the suffering of the victims. On the other hand, the unmediated, unvarnished testimony of the victims or witnesses is commonly regarded as the sole adequate vehicle for invoking, representing, and transmitting the beastly world of the concentrationary universe. Critical evaluations of Holocaust literature have thus largely been shaped by a general mistrust of invention, experimentation, and fabulation, and a concomitant privileging of testimony and witnessing grounded in personal experience. Perhaps the poles of this opposition can be best elucidated by turning to well-known examples drawn from visual culture. In 1979, the NBC miniseries Holocaust, which captivated international audiences, may have done more than any other single work to reinvoke the historical significance of the Holocaust for an American and European public diverted from this past atrocity by the more immediate tensions and political animosities of the Cold War. Widely criticized for its tendency towards sentimentalism and the trivialization of historical facts, this work nonetheless served the function of elevating popular awareness about the Holocaust, especially in Germany, where it was shown in four installments in 1 week in 1979 and invoked such things as this cover article in Spiegel was hotly debated. But fictionalization, especially in such melodramatic, popularizing, easily digestible forms, often gives rise to criticisms of inaccuracy and tranquilizing pacification. The opposite end of the spectrum from these manifestations of Hollywood fabulation is occupied by Claude Lanzmann's monumental testimonial film Shoah of 1985. Based solely on interviews with both victims and perpetrators, Lanzmann's film evinces an aesthetic austerity and an insistence on evidentiary experience that stands in marked contrast to more popular forms of Holocaust cinema. To be sure, even the immediacy of testimony is anything but unproblematic. Primo Levi, himself a survivor of the camps, was the first to point out that the genuine victims were those who succumbed to the human degradation and overweening brutality of the camps, those to whom he referred as the drowned. And he insisted that their testimony as the only truly authentic witnessing of unimaginable personal trauma will never become part of the historical record. The testimony of the survivors, all those who were saved, by contrast, saved is Livy's word, is by its very nature incomplete and skewed. The survivors, after all, among whom Livy numbers himself, were those who made accommodations to and compromises with the inhumane conditions of the camps. Those who, in Levy's words, I'm quoting him, by their prevarications or abilities or good luck did not touch bottom, end quote. Moreover, even the reliability of the testimony presented by those who survived, in Levy's view, must be called into question. For human memory, as he remarks, quote, is a marvelous but fallacious instrument, end quote. And those who survived, quote again, have ever more blurred and stylized memories, often unbeknownst to them, influenced by information gained from later readings or the stories of others. So this idea of even testimony being somehow stylized and reliant on perhaps fictional other narrative models will become important at a later point in my talk. This susceptibility of traumatic memory to transmogrifying, falsifying influences from other sources significantly raises the stakes in the controversy between fabulative and factual representation. For it introduces the possibility that even purported witness accounts could be unwittingly metahistorical in Hayden White's sense, shaped and manipulated by poetic narratives popularized and transmitted through various media. If historical events of extreme violence and intense human suffering tend naturally to call forth a demand for what James Young has termed factually insistent narrative, one should not deny the existence of certain oppositional voices that valorize imaginative amplification and fabulative reconstruction as the most viable modality for preserving and communicating the experience of events so horrendous that they are deemed both unimaginable and unspeakable. Recently, Ruth Kluger, herself a Holocaust survivor, literary critic, and author of a well-received Holocaust memoir, argued that the most apt literary strategies for portraying the anonymous suffering of Holocaust victims might be drawn from the tradition of literary modernism, from the experimental techniques employed by such figures as James Joyce and Franz Kafka. The prominent historian of the Holocaust, Dominic Lacopra, has reinforced this view, citing authors such as Kafka, Maurice Blanchot, Paul Celan, and Samuel Beckett as practitioners of a performative mode of writing that serves as a model for a literature of, quote, terrorized disempowerment, end quote. For Lacopra, such approaches approximate the experience of traumatized victims without making pretensions to realistically representing this situation or this experience. Perhaps it's fitting, a fitting irony, that this invocation of the exemplary status of literary modernism's poetic innovations brings us back to Adorno. The very aestheticizing features that for him call for an interdiction of Holocaust representation are invoked by Kluge and Lacopra as a potential solution to the inherent dilemma associated with the literary representation of atrocity. Surely the critic who has made the most sustained case for the appropriateness of an imaginative and fabulative approach to the Holocaust is Lawrence Langer. In Langer's view, if imaginative engagement with the Holocaust manifests an ameliorative strategy, then this has the positive effect of allowing us to face, in effigy, as it were, a reality so monstrous that our immediate inclination is to turn away. In its perfected forms, a literature of atrocity, this is Langer's term, a literature of atrocity creates alternate fictional worlds that both insist on their affinity, but not identity, with the egregious historical events, but also form a kind of palliative that makes the reality approachable and digestible. This strategy might be termed one of imaginative indirection. Langer himself employs the phrase a literature of innuendo. And he sees its culmination in, quoting Langer, a wedding of history and innovation, end quote. This is precisely the case I will try to make for W.G. Sebald's approach to the Holocaust. One final peculiarity of Holocaust literature needs to be outlined before we can turn to the context of recent German Holocaust literature more generally and the works of Sebald specifically. This is the relationship between authorial voice and the depicted events. Literary studies in general, of course, have been guided for several decades by a tendency to celebrate rather than to mourn the death of the author. In contrast to this, critics of Holocaust literature are often notoriously conservative, holding the work up to the acid test of factually insistent narrative on the one hand, and stipulating on the other that the author's biography lend authority to her or his portrayal. Thus, Sue Weiss, a critic of Holocaust fiction, designates as one of the three central categories constitutive of Holocaust fiction and is a primary basis for its critical evaluation, a requisite homology between the empirical author and the textual narrator. Le Capre refers to a standard grid of Holocaust subject positions, which encompass such roles as victims, perpetrators, collaborators, bystanders, resistors, and those born after the fact. And he notes the significance of breaking out of this grid-like topology by negotiating subject positions that fall between or outside of these standardized roles. This is also a vision that looks ahead to the advances that one that can be identified in Sebald's Holocaust narratives. The situation of Holocaust fiction in general is thus notoriously precarious, confronting authors with complex, often contradictory demands between historical accuracy, authentic depiction, imaginative involvement with the victims, and fabulative elaboration on historical atrocities. For obvious reasons, this problematic is even more complex for German language writers. And thus it might be understandable that Germans long shied away from fictional engagements with the Holocaust thematic. The primary complication for the Germans in general, of course, was that they not only needed to come to terms with the experience of the victims, asking how such systematically orchestrated acts of brutality against humanity were possible at all, but also to contend with the guilt and shame of the perpetrators, which meant asking how it was possible that Germans, with their deeply rooted traditions in Enlightenment rationality, humanistic learning, and cultural intellectual innovation, could mastermind, organize, and participate in a widespread program of mass human terror and extermination. The psychological responses and consequences of this so-called confrontation with the past have often been investigated, and I don't need to rehearse them again here. Although there's a dearth of Holocaust testimonials written in German, two works stand out in particular. The camp memoir, Beyond Guilt and Repentance, by Jean Amery, a persecuted Austrian Jew who abandoned his given name of Hans Meyer after the war and documented his harassment and torture by the Nazis. Amery's writings were an important model also for, and his life for Sebald as well. The second is the belatedly published diaries of romance scholar Victor Klemperer, a Jew who survived the Nazi period in Germany because he had a non-Jewish German wife and who detailed the tribulations of day-to-day life for a Jew in Nazi Germany in a secret diary, which was published in retrospect. By and large, literary immersion in the events of the Holocaust initially took the form of a strictly applied documentary realism, represented above all in Peter Weiss's The Investigation, 1965, which manifested responses to the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem in 1961 and the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trials that were taking place between 1963 and 1965. The fact that Weiss selected the form of documentary theater likely reflects the wish to transform these public legal spectacles, which received widespread worldwide attention, into more focused theatrical spectacles that would provide space for the German public to reflect critically on their own involvement in these historical events. The interrogation of a handful of perpetrators could thereby be extended more broadly to the German public at large, in the hope of circumventing the danger that the prosecution of specific culprits would lead to a more general sense of exculpation by everyday Germans. But only subsequent to German unification in 1989 can one speak of a minor boom in German fictional engagements with the Holocaust. There are several reasons for this. One is the reemergence of a reunified German national state and the perceived need to reinterrogate the aberration of past German attempts at nation building. More important, however, is surely the emergence of a new generation of writers, the so-called second generation, born during or after the war, whose association with the crimes of the Holocaust is less direct and immediate, whose psychological baggage is considerably lighter, and who, as a result, can tackle this thematic with considerably less constraint and more circumspection. The landscape of recent German Holocaust fiction, not surprisingly, is shaped by the same tension between sentimentalized fictionalization on the one hand and an insistence on documentary realism and authentic testimony on the other, a tension that characterizes Holocaust fiction in general. In order to orient W.G. Sebald's work on this terrain, I will discuss very briefly two prominent Holocaust texts, both of which were published in 1995 and which exemplify these tensions especially well: Bernard Schlink's The Reader and Benjamin Wilkomirski's Fragments, Memories of a Wartime Childhood. Bernard Schlink's The Reader scarcely requires an introduction, especially since its filming is a successful and titillating motion picture. I tried to add some of that titillation to my slide. The novel itself has been subject to precisely that kind of critical response that is typical of much Holocaust fiction in general. While it has received high popular acclaim, both in Germany and abroad, even ascending to the ranks of those books discussed in Oprah Winfrey's book club, this is real appeal. Academic criticism has been much more circumspect, muted, and critical. To be sure, the fact alone that a German writer could garner so much popular recognition for a work of Holocaust fiction is a minor accomplishment in itself. One telling symptom of this recognition is the widespread adoption of Schlink's novel for school curricula on the Holocaust in Germany. This is, I think, a troubling phenomenon if we think of the Holocaust as a historical event being filtered through a novel written in 1995. But nonetheless, it's true. This is what's happening in Germany at the moment. The novel's first-person narrator, Michael Berg, relates his childhood erotic involvement with an older woman, Hannah Schmidt, who turns out to have been a concentration camp guard and is later put on trial and convicted for her crimes. The work has alternately either been praised for its more nuanced and compassionate portrayal of a perpetrator, or criticized for its marginalization of the real victims of the Holocaust and its tendency to position Germans, both perpetrators and second generation, as victims of circumstance. Schlink's primary literary achievement, aside from his ability to create a highly readerly and popular work that engages in complex ways with questions of German guilt, responsibility, and shame for the Holocaust atrocities, is the expedient of underpinning this otherwise simple an engaging narrative with the structure of detective fiction. His first-person narrator finds himself in the position of having to uncover Hannah's well-concealed secret, the illiteracy that gives rise to profound shame and that plays an obscure role in her development into a perpetrator. The artistry, and I think the metafictional aspect of Schlink's text, is linked to its capacity to keep this secret in suspense, so that the reader participates in his narrator's process of discovery. This surprising linkage of the serious problematic of Holocaust shame and responsibility with the lowbrow genre of the detective novel represents the major metafictional innovation of Schlink's work. It's not surprising that he would be the one who did this, since he is the author of several popular detective stories prior to the publication of The Reader. Benjamin Milkremirsky's Fragments of a Wartime Childhood is similarly steeped in considerable critical controversy, but for reasons that are very different. Originally published under the pretense of being an authentic Holocaust memoir, pieced together in retrospect through the resurgence of childhood memories, this work immediately garnered sustained critical and popular recognition. It won several awards in France, the United States, and elsewhere. The problem is that Benjamin Milkremirsky, as Daniel Gansfried was the first to reveal, turns out to be the assumed name of a certain Bruno Dussecker, a non-Jewish Swiss citizen whose purported autobiography is a matter of pure invention. Scholars are currently undecided whether to evaluate this as a blatant case of literary fraud or as an instance of psychological self-deception, whereby Dussecker himself has succumbed to a pathological identification with the victims of Holocaust trauma. The debates go back and forth on this evaluation. The latter, more generous view assumes that Dussecker mistakenly integrated into his own life story, as false memories, information from Holocaust memoirs, films, documentaries, and fictions. This is the place where I link back up with Primo Levi's idea about the stylization of genuine Holocaust memoirs. Yet even when its factuality has been completely debunked, as it has, this work can still be taken as an exemplary model of Holocaust metafiction, perhaps the most deceptive form, because it made people believe that it truly was a genuine memoir. Not only does it play effectively with the central themes of fragmentary memory and the belated recouping of traumatic experiences, but it also strategically mimics the randomness of memory recall in the fragmentary and haphazard structure of its retelling. Long introduction. Now Seba. Since the German publication of the Ausgewanderten, The Emigrants, in 1992, and its translation into English as The Emigrants in 1995, W.G. Sebald and his writings have commonly been associated with the Holocaust thematic. Maybe I should say as a footnote that I opposed vehemently for several years this association with Sebald with the Holocaust for reasons mainly because I thought the trivial associations that were being made. And now I find myself in this strange position of defending that, but on a different level, I hope, because for me it's a matter of the structural and aesthetic elements of Sebald's texts that operate towards the vitalization of the Holocaust thematic. Yet the connections between the four biographical tales collected in the volume The Emigrants and the events of the Holocaust are not always obvious. One character is a Lithuanian Jew whose family immigrated to England prior to the First World War. Another, a German of mixed Jewish descent, who loses his teaching position under the Nazis but serves in the German military during the Second World War. A third is not Jewish at all, but instead a homosexual uncle of Sewald's first-person narrator who emigrates to America long before the Holocaust. The fourth, finally, is in fact a Jew who fled the Holocaust as a child and settled in England. What unites these characters more than anything else is a situation of being emotionally displaced. Indeed, Sewald's German title for this collection, Die Ausgewanderten, rather than the more common Die Auswanderer, contains the implication that these figures are not voluntary immigrants to new worlds, but instead involuntarily dislocated and displaced individuals. This vague sense of dislocation haunts their lives and expresses itself as a pervasive melancholy, culminating in the suicide of the first three protagonists and the near suicide of the fourth. It's not an uplifting book, but it's still a good read. If these stories present a complexly refracted perspective on the Holocaust on the level of story, this deflection is also incorporated into the narrative structure of the tales themselves. Each biography is told by a present-day first-person narrator who shares a few sparsely presented biographical features with the empirical author, Sewald, and whose first-person voice, the embedded first-person voice of each informant merges. This embedding of first-person narratives within the context of an overriding first-person narrative framework is one of the distinctive tokens of Sewald's fiction. Developed most fully in Sewald's final prose fiction, Austerlitz, this technique can be viewed as a literary instantiation of the secondary witness, whose labor of listening and attending opens the witnessing individual up to empathetic understanding and a muted sense of shared trauma. I'm alluding to Dominic Lacapra in those words. Sewald himself was keenly aware of the difficulties attendant upon any literary engagement with the Holocaust. In an interview with Maya Yaghi, conducted in 2001, shortly before his death, Sewald pointedly remarked, this is an English interview, "I don't think you can focus on the horror of the Holocaust. It's like the head of Medusa. You carry it around with you in a sack, but if you looked at it, you'd be petrified." Thus, for Sewald, the Holocaust presents a kind of historical baggage that one can neither set aside nor somehow escape, but with which one must necessarily have an oblique or mediated relationship, viewing it through a shield, so to speak, or through its reflection. We're reminded here of Saul Friedlander's assertion that one can only approach the Holocaust by means of what he calls elusive realism, or of Lawrence Langer's claim that innuendo is the only proper literary mode for dealing with atrocity. What is unique about Sewald's prose fiction, however, is that his pervasive implementation of diverse metafictional techniques as a way to accomplish this refraction that permits engagement with the otherwise unspeakable horror of the Holocaust. In order to offer a few telling examples of this, I'll turn to Sewald's last work, published just before his untimely death in 2001, the extended prose narrative Austerlitz. Austerlitz is a work of documentary fiction. Its central character, Jacques Austerlitz, who is also the primary informant for Sewald's trademark anonymous first-person narrator, is another displaced person like the biographical figures of the emigrants. Born to Jewish parents in Prague prior to the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia, he is sent to England with the Kindertransport, the small-scale organized operation for rescuing Jewish children from Eastern Europe. And he grows up with Welsh foster parents under the assumed name David Elias. Only much later is his true identity revealed to him, and he subsequently devotes his life to reconstructing his lost childhood and trying to discover the fate of his parents, who perished in the Holocaust. Sebald's oblique perspective on the Holocaust is already evident in the storyline, which focuses not so much on the primary victims of the Nazi terror as on the collateral trauma of a survivor whose life has been transformed by events with which he has only a mediated relationship. Moreover, the character Austerlitz himself and his fictional life represent a composite of various historical personalities, as Sebald was quick to admit. One central component is the story of Susie Bechhofer, who experienced the Kindertransport and whose life was retold in the book Rosa's Child. Another major source was Saul Friedlander's autobiography, of which a heavily annotated copy can be found in Sebald's library. Like Austerlitz, Friedlander was born in Prague, lost his parents in the Holocaust, and was raised as a foster child in France, not in England, where he, again like Austerlitz, was raised in the Christian religion. Austerlitz also bears certain traits borrowed from Ludwig Wittgenstein, and this connection perhaps underwrites in part this fictional character's architectural interests. Wittgenstein, among other things, was also an architect. Sebald's protagonist thus is constructed as a kind of composite of intertextual allusions, combining traits from historically prominent individuals and personal life stories. This has opened this character up to severe objections by some critics, small group, who view him, as this character, as piecemeal and artificial. Yet that's precisely the point of Sebald's technique. The multiple allusions to real figures and events invoke what Roland Barthes has called the reality effect, by bringing the fictional tale into close alignment with real, documented occurrences that are likely to have a ring of familiarity with a whole panoply of readers. The fiction resides, as is often the case for metafictional texts, in the recombinatory practice that splices together fragments from diverse sources to form a quilt or mosaic that makes pretense to its own aesthetic totality. Sebald's works are replete with self-reflexive deliberations on this combinatory practice. In Austerlitz, we discover self-reflections on this structure in the eponymous protagonist's search for, quote, family resemblances, a Wittgensteinian term, in historically diverse architectural monuments. Or more pointedly, in the game in which he lays out photographs on a table and constantly rearranges them in order to discover the hidden connections that link them together. Both this combinatory practice and the tendency to self-consciously reflect on the very structures that fashion the fictional work are central attributes of metafiction. Raymond Federman, for example, one of the literary originators of the idea of metafiction, has called the metafictional writer a plagiarist by design. It has maintained that for modern writers, imagination is not an operation that creates something new, but instead, quoting Federman, imitates, copies, repeats, proliferates, plagiarizes, in other words, what has already been there. End quote. In Austerlitz, Sebald has perfected this art of the metafictional plagiarist and brought it to bear, I would argue, productively on the thematic of the Holocaust. This is form without substance. We can elucidate how Sebald creatively appropriates metafictional strategies for their application to Holocaust fiction by examining the narrative structure of Austerlitz. In this work, Sebald in many ways perfects the Chinese box structure of embedded first-person narratives that he practiced in his earlier works. Once again, he adheres to the technique of constructing a first-person frame narrator. Critics usually talk about Sebald in quotation marks. a frame narrator who resembles the empirical author himself. As in the case of Wilkomirski's Fragments of a Wartime Childhood, this ontological union between author and narrator is of crucial importance in the critical evaluation of Holocaust fiction. In Sebald's text, however, this connection is neither absolutely asserted nor denied. Indeed, it's consciously suspended in a web of indeterminacy that raises more questions than it can possibly resolve. Sabout seems to play deliberately on this issue of ontological identification in order to throw it open as a problem area of Holocaust fiction, or perhaps of documentary fiction more generally. This problem is compounded by the fact that Sabout's narrator is not the immediate source of the diegetic information, but merely a reporter or witness of someone else's, namely Austerlitz's, testimony. But this relationship of informant to chronicler is further replicated within the storyline of Austerlitz's autobiography itself, since this character is dependent on other individuals or on written texts and other documents as the sources of information about his own life. So you see here this idea of these Chinese box narratives with the first-person narrator, Austerlitz is the main informant, and then other informants. And all of these people, as we'll see, use the first-person form of address in Sabout's text. That's what makes it unusual. Thus, Sabout relies, for example, on the testimony, or the narrator relies, for example, on the testimony, and Austerlitz relies on the testimony of his former nanny, Vera, for facts about his childhood. This structure becomes even more complicated, however, when within Vera's narrative, which is within Austerlitz's narrative, which is within the narrator's narrative, Austerlitz's deceased parents, Maximilian and Agatha, assume roles as narrators in their own right. What is peculiar to this structure of nesting narratives in Sabout's text is that each of these voices is allowed to assume the diction of the first person. So they're testimonies, in the first-person testimonies. As a result, the text unfolds as a series of interlocking testimonials, so that the recovery of the past, and even of one's own personal history, is portrayed in terms of a telescoping structure of testimonial evidence. So we move through these different layers, always coming back to this first-person form of ich in the German and I in the English translations, to the point where at some places in the text it's hard to know, hard to remember who's talking, except that Sabout has this strange quirk in this text where he says things like, said Austerlitz, said Vera, said Agatha. Very strange and a kind of jarring narrative intrusion. By means of this tactic, Sabout is able to instantiate on the level of narrative structure both the temporal alienation from distant, if influential, historical events and the interhuman, indeed, the narrative linkages that provide the only avenue to access these occurrences. So all these white lines between these different boxes of narrative voices are this kind of transitional space where the identification between these first-person narrators takes place. In a seeming paradox, while each subsequent testimonial layer gets closer to the historical, to the experience of the historical source event, namely the Holocaust, it simultaneously adds increasing dimensions of mediation and hence of potential distortion. This technique thereby represents an ideal method for invoking issues related to the precarious access to past historical events. Sabout's text does not merely draw attention to the problematic of traumatic memory that is tied to horrendous historical experiences, but also calls attention to the complex problem of historical transmission and our increasingly mediated access to critical historical data. History becomes a matter of hearsay, added to hearsay, supplemented by hearsay. Sabout thereby aesthetically invokes one of the most critical problems in Holocaust studies in general: how to capture, preserve, and transmit the horrible nature of these events in all their immediacy. His text asks on the level of narrative structure how we can find a ground for judging the authenticity of testimony given this constant narrative refraction of the facts. At this point, we're approaching, of course, Hayden White's position that historical accounts are always shaped by certain tropes and strategies of implotment, so that the historical data potentially become as elusive as the Kantian thing in itself. Sebald even adds an additional complication to this assessment by demonstrating the way in which historical accounts are not simply secondary implotments of a given set of first-order facts, but instead are tertiary or even fourth-order retellings of prior narratives. But one can also view Sebald's peculiar narrative technique from another perspective, one that both reinforces its relevance for the Holocaust thematic and offers a potential solution for the dilemma of historical transmission. For it operates by laminating together the structure of witness narrative and testimonial narrative. What this means is that each character in the text, whether it's the anonymous first-person narrator, the character Austerlitz, or even Vera, the nanny, performs a double role as both witness to and chronicler of the testimony of others. On the one hand, and testimonial voice of his or her own experiences on the other. So the witness narrative moves from the outside to the inside, with each outer box being the witness to the testimony of the person on the next level. And the testimonial function works the other direction, so that the Agata is testifying to Vera. Vera's testimony is transmitted then to Austerlitz, which then is transmitted to Sebald's narrator, which then is transmitted, of course, ultimately to us as the readers. This is perhaps most pronounced on the level of Sebald's narrator, who stands completely outside of the life of Austerlitz, to which he is bearing witness via his narrative, but who also operates as a pseudo-autobiographical testifier to his own life experiences, which in part parallel those of Austerlitz. Similarly, Austerlitz, when he takes over the first-person form, functions as an autobiographical self-witness. But when he passes the first-person position onto others, he becomes the witness to their testimony. Implicit in this witness-informant interaction is a kind of interpersonal bonding that accepts the accuracy, authenticity, and emotional valence of the reported testimony. In a word, the glue that fuses witness narrative to testimony is a profound form of empathy that brings narrator and informant into a kind of emotional union. The interstitial space that marks the divide between witness and informant is infused with a conductive material that permits both personal experiences and their emotive auras to be transmitted between figures. Under such conditions of receptivity, even when the facts of historical events are subject to deflections and alienating distortions, their emotional essence or traumatic force can still be handed down. This is precisely the structure that Dominic Lacapra calls empathetic unsettlement, which he is careful to distinguish not only from facile forms of identification, but also from simple appropriation of the other's experience. Lacapra defines this attitude as, quoting Lacapra, a kind of virtual experience through which one puts oneself in the other's position while recognizing the difference of that position and hence not taking the other's place, end quote. This strikes me as an illuminating and apt description for the relationship between witness and informant on diverse levels of Sebald's narrative. It's no longer a matter of achieving undiluted access to indubitable facts, but instead of approximating the affective force associated with human experience of those facts. In order to better understand this concept of empathetic unsettlement, and the appropriateness of its application to intersubjective relationships in Sebald's Austerlitz, we can draw on another related conceptual instrument proposed by Lacapra. This is the distinction between historical and structural trauma. For Lacapra, historical trauma relates to the impact a traumatic event has on its immediate victims, And hence, historical trauma is tied to real experience and its emotional repercussions. Structural trauma, by contrast, represents a more diffuse, less immediate experience of trauma. It is universal to all people, as opposed to the temporal specificity of historical trauma. And Lekapra correlates it with what he calls trans-historical absence. Structural trauma has no immediate identifiable source, but rather takes the form of a kind of meta-empirical haunting, a general malaise or discontent predicated on a persistent but nevertheless mediated consciousness of traumatic historical circumstances. Structural trauma strikes me as a potentially more precise, critically more provocative term for describing what is commonly identified as the melancholic attitude of Sebald's texts in particular, and his worldview more generally. It encompasses the emotional register of that natural history of destruction, term Sebald liked to use, to which Sebald, his narrator, and his fictional characters prominently allude. Moreover, it highlights the fact that melancholy need not imply passive resignation, but can also embody, as Sebald himself once asserted, a vehicle of active political cultural resistance. From the perspective of this natural history of destruction, as a catastrophe caused by the German people. But for him, it represents the perverse culmination of a much more general and diffuse European phenomenon, which he identifies with the politics of mastery, underwritten by an intemperate instrumental rationality that seeks to establish sterile order at any cost. For Sebald, the affinity of the Holocaust with this greater European political and intellectual historical tradition renders it even more horrendous than if it were an isolated and hence unique event. In Sebald's case, it seems likely that an awareness of this European history, especially given the purported inevitability with which it produced the gruesome events of the Holocaust, constitutes the fundamental condition of possibility for the experience of structural trauma. This vague sense of trauma based on unnamed, unnameable, and all-pervasive historical events. In Austerlitz, the aura of this history of Europe as a linked set of acts of devastation pervades the consciousness of the first-person narrator. Yet when comprehended as a particularly invasive form of structural trauma, the seemingly melancholic demeanor goes far beyond fatalism, pessimism, and resignation in the face of overpowering historical forces. It forms the prerequisite for the narrator's empathetic relationship with Austerlitz and is the condition of possibility for his own empathetic unsettlement. What Sebald's text relates in the interaction between Austerlitz and the anonymous first-person narrator is the resonance of the former, that is, Austerlitz's historical trauma, when it strikes the sounding board of the narrator's structural trauma. So I want to conclude this discussion of Sebald's text by examining an episode that illuminates the nature of this empathetic relationship, but that also ties back to my arguments about Sebald's appropriation of metafictional strategies for the Holocaust thematic. I'm referring to the extended footnote that Sebald's narrator introduces when he is scarcely 10 pages into his over 400-page narrative, 400 pages in the German edition. It's occasioned during his very first discussion with Austerlitz by this informant's remark that the architectural model for the Antwerp train station in which this exchange takes place was the train station at Lucerne, Switzerland. At this juncture, an asterisk interrupts Austerlitz's description in mid-sentence and leads the reader to a discursive footnote that spans 3 pages in the German edition and includes its own illustration. Now, this type of narrative intervention, which disrupts the fictional text and inserts a passage dominated by extreme narrative self-consciousness, is a common device of metafiction. Sebald's footnote begins, significantly, with a self-reflexive comment by the narrator about something that struck him as he reread his own text. He was doing proofs or reading his handwritten notes or something like that. Quote, "In the process of reviewing these notes, I now recall once again that in February 1971, during a brief visit to Switzerland, I also spent some time in Lucerne." Well, very interesting. Now it's a travelogue. What makes this footnote surprising is not merely the way in which it so abruptly tears the reader away from the narrative at the very moment it's struggling to gain momentum, but also the self-reflexive gesture with which the narrator refers to his own rereading of this very text and the supplementary thoughts this act of secondary reading provoked. This note goes on to relate how the narrator stood for a long time on the bridge in Lucerne and studied the cupola of the train station from a distance. "That night," he continues, "while he was asleep in his hotel room, this train station caught fire, and the cupola was almost completely destroyed." At this point, he inserts into the footnote an illustration. This is the illustration. Of the burning Lucerne station, purportedly taken from the newspaper report about the fire that he read the next day. So he just remembered accidentally this that he experienced this event, but somehow he happened to have the newspaper at his disposal. These images, he claims, stuck in his memory for many weeks, accompanied by something disquieting and anxiety-causing that ultimately condensed around the impression, quote, that I was the guilty party, or at the very least, an accomplice who was responsible for the fire in the Lucerne train station, end quote. The footnote concludes with the narrator's confession that even years later, his dreams continued to be haunted by the picture of this flaming cupola. Now, a great deal must be at stake for Sebald's narrator in order to justify the introduction of this obtrusive footnote at this crucial juncture in his narrative. The associative logic with which he moves from Austerlitz's historical reference to his own personal experience is clearly central, since it models in miniature the transference that will take place between Austerlitz's narrative and the narrator's own life experiences. Moreover, since it's added to the narrative in retrospect, this footnote performs a general proleptic function. It looks ahead, elliptically anticipating in its images of fire and destruction the Holocaust thematic that will turn out to be the source of Austerlitz's historical trauma, about which we know nothing at this point in Sebald's text. This footnote further thematizes the narrator's position as a bystander and seemingly impartial observer. Yet this very act of distanced observation, paradoxically, somehow implicates him in the history of the things he observes. The personal stance described here is thus a more general one of affected observation. There simply is no sensible explanation for the personal responsibility Sebald's narrator feels for the fire in the station he had merely observed. But this episode is a vehicle for introducing, through a metafictional backdoor, the theme of implied complicity for events on which one has neither influence nor control. There are many dimensions to this theme of guilt that Sebald's narrator introduces via this metafictional footnote. It can be seen to stand for the shame and guilt of second-generation Germans, like Sebald's narrator and Sebald himself, who cannot avoid sharing the responsibility for the Holocaust, even though they had no direct involvement. But on another level, it also could be seen to represent the shame and guilt of the survivors among the victims themselves. Those who, to allude to the words of Primo Levi once more, were not drowned, but instead, like Jacques Austerlitz, were saved. Austerlitz, of course, must struggle to reconstruct the reasons for his expulsion from the family. But throughout his life, he's dogged by the belief that he himself must somehow have been to blame for his banishment, this idea of shame associated with one's own victimhood. One might even speculate that this sense of guilt constitutes, at least in part, the shared experience that makes possible the empathy between Sebald's German narrator witness and his Jewish informant survivor. I'm almost done. One could certainly examine more of the various metafictional devices employed by Sebald in this work. for their relevance to the Holocaust problematic. My investigation is largely ignored, for example, one of Sebald's most widely acknowledged innovations, his inclusion of things like photographs, diagrams, reproductions of souvenirs, or other objects and texts that play a role in the narrative unfolding. On the most general level, these illustrations highlight the tensions between empirical documentary fact and fabulative fiction that is of central importance for all of Sebald's prose fictions. These illustrations, like Sebald's metafictional strategies in general, help shape this oblique approach to the Holocaust. However, it's not just a matter of trying to discover a shield that allows one to look upon the head of Medusa without being petrified, as Sebald remarked, but also of coming to terms in a work of fiction with the very questions and problems that have been constitutive of Holocaust fiction and its reception, with themes of guilt, shame, and secondary responsibility, with the crucial problem of empathy and the relationships between victims and the successor generation of the perpetrators, with the insistence on the ontological connections between authors and narrators, and most importantly, with the fundamental issue of how we can gain access to, preserve in narrative forms, and effectively transmit traumatic incidents from the past in all their traumatic force. Sebald's artistry consists, in my view, in his ability to demonstrate the applicability and relevance of metafictional strategies for the exploration and elucidation of these crucial problems. His prose texts have suggested possible ways in which the genre of documentary fiction might be transformed into an enhanced form that could go by the name of documentary metafiction, which seems like a contradiction in terms, of course. Most importantly, Sebald's Holocaust metafictions instantiate a method for transmitting the structural trauma of the Holocaust so as to guarantee that it is passed on, even if in refracted form, to future generations. Metafiction becomes a method for ensuring that the Holocaust stays alive as a traumatic memory, a way of certifying that, even as the historical events recede into the past, humans will continue to experience the requisite unsettlement that the reality of such past horrors must invoke. Thank you.